a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first and third Saturdays of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. Today's show, we're going to be talking about virtual patching, toll fraud, and otherwise known as the new version of that, just straight-up telecom fraud, which also involves fraud on your cell phone lines, the Amazon Echo, and then the viability of running a virtual machine on a NAS, because this still seems to be quite a hot, interesting topic of contention lately. So I'm going to cover that in technical detail and feasibility detail as to whether or not that's an approach that even makes any sense. So let's start off with virtual patching. This is a massive big deal, and virtual patching is basically a methodology whereby you create certain security rules at the network layer in order to close security holes, close vulnerabilities. That's why they call it virtual patching, because you're not actually patching the underlying systems themselves. And the reason that virtual patching is so crucial is because first off, you have certain types of systems that you really just can't patch anymore. And there's an awful lot of companies that have them. And, for example, that might be a situation where a company has an application that they had paid perpetual licensing, means that they were permanently licensed for that software and they could afford it. When it was hosted in-house, when it was perpetually licensed, they could afford it. Well, maybe their software vendor has now gone to a cloud-only model, and it just turns into financial unobtainium. And I know of at least one example of exactly that sort of thing happening. So the company is forced to keep an old system around, running it as a virtual machine for, I guess, the indefinite future, until some technical thing, some sort of technical requirement makes that approach absolutely impossible. So what do you do then if you can't patch this thing? You can't install security patches on it anymore to keep it up to date, because that operating system isn't supported anymore. Well, you have to do virtual patching. So that's one example. There's another example that is enormous, and it has to do with medical systems. So let's say you're looking at a Gendex scanner as a fine example, and or other brands of CT scanners made by General Electric, or any number of medical imaging equipment where you have the actual imaging equipment, but then that immediately feeds DICOM images into a computer processing system, which I call it that because there's generally more than one computer involved. There's usually kind of 2-3 computers involved, at least. Well, what if you can't patch that system? And I have yet to see a medical imaging system that can be fully and correctly patched. In fact, I've seen just a plethora of stupidity around these systems where, they claim that their software is reliant upon Java, but then you can't update Java. Or the machine itself is malfunctioning. I'm not exaggerating this. I've actually seen this. The machine itself is malfunctioning. The fix for the problem is to do a BIOS update on the system because there's a bug in the motherboard that needs to be patched. But the Gendex scanner company that makes the CT scanner will not allow the BIOS update to be installed on the system because they haven't certified that system with that particular patch. And, they don't update things. They maybe go through an update cycle maybe once every 6 to 8 years. So the problem that happens there is, what do you do in the meantime? You know, and there, I literally saw ridiculousness from them where when Windows XP was no longer supported, when Windows 7 was no longer supported, and newer operating systems were out, and we could have easily purchased a significantly less expensive system that was fully supported and just put their fancy little video card in there and then put their software on it. That was completely unacceptable to them. They refused to do any support on it. So it's a bit of a rigged market. And I would say the medical imaging equipment suppliers do an atrociously bad job. I mean, atrociously bad of managing their systems in an appropriate life cycle, and they're not keeping software up to date. They also have crazy requirements, such as they want that system to be internet accessible. I'm not kidding you. They want it to be internet accessible so that they can have remote access support to the system. But then at the same time, they refuse to have endpoint security product on the computer system. And if you install any patches for Java, you know, or anything like that, then they just, you know, they flip out. So they simultaneously want the computer to be connected to the internet and internet accessible, but yet they don't want to do anything to make it so that that process can happen securely. Well, what do you have then as an option? You pretty much have one option, which is called virtual patching, which means that you deploy network security rules in order to look at all of the network traffic going to and from that system and ensure that it is safe. You know, it's obviously 5 billion times more sophisticated and complicated than that, but that's effectively what you're trying to do. Now, that being said, virtual patching is not easy. It's really not easy. I mean, you have to, it's really, really not easy. And you have to have a very, very concerted, ongoing, consistent effort in order to have many layers of security, even at the network layer. You might have to have virtualized that system, or you might have to put a special piece of network equipment in between it and other systems, whether that be a virtualized network equipment or not, you know. But anyways, it's effectively what you're doing is intercepting all traffic to and from and writing very stringent rules. And then even for what you are allowing, you're doing very deep inspection on it. And I think that the reason that we continue to have so many breaches is because of two factors. Number one is that organizations, to the vast majority, I mean, something in excess of like 80% of organizations are not patching in a timely fashion. I mean, I still hear of wailing and gnashing of teeth over the requirements of PCI compliance, which I think are extremely lenient. I mean, PCI compliance is composed of many facets, but one of these facets is that you're supposed to deploy all of the patches to the point of sale, PCI, payment card industry involved systems within 28 days of the patch's release. Well, 28 days, I think, is a ridiculous time period. They should be able to get it done within 48 hours, seriously. So 28 days is more than generous. And the reality is that the vast majority of organizations are still not hitting the 28-day marker. And Conducive some months ago put out a blog post where they were talking about how they spent a tremendous amount of energy to develop their latest generation of software that did not require a reboot in order to install it or update it. And the reason that they had put so much energy and effort into the development of that particular technology was because they were getting feedback from like 95% of their customers, which granted, I'll tell you, is mostly enterprise, but they were getting feedback from virtually every one of their customers that rebooting their systems was just impossible. You know, like they haven't rebooted their systems in 6 months, and they don't have a change window to allow. They don't have the allowable downtime to allow for the rebooting of these systems. And my, you know, from where I sit with more than 25 years of experience in the industry and some significant numbers of years of that experience being involved directly in Fortune 500 companies, not being able to reboot a system for 6 months is beyond ridiculous. Most companies that I've ever worked with who did take security seriously, and this is the caveat, those that actually took security seriously came up with either a weekly change window or a bi-monthly change window. Where you'd either do it every, you know, I don't know, Thursday morning at 4 a.m., Wednesday evening, Sunday morning, whatever, you're picking some time frame. Or you say, okay, well, we're going to do it every other weekend of every month, or we're going to do it every other Thursday morning. And you can spread out, I think the either the weekly approach is necessary, or the approach of doing it twice a month is necessary. Any less frequent than that is just ridiculous. And the reason I say that is because, first of all, you have to close these security gaps. You have to patch. But you also don't want to be doing all of your patches in one shot. You have a lot of systems to patch. More often than not, you have wireless network infrastructure, you have switching infrastructure, core network infrastructure, workstations, software packages, servers, and you know, and I could go on and on and on. But there are so many things that need babysitting and maintaining and patching all of the time that if you try to cram all of that into a once a month patch cycle, you're never going to get it done. And you're changing too many things at one point in time in the organization, which is a danger into itself. So I'm a huge fan of either patch within 48 hours of the patch's release, which means you very well could be doing it at night. You could be doing an overnight patch. Some patches can and should just be hot deployed in the middle of the day. And we've been doing that for 20 years. And I mean, if you know what you're doing with the patch, you can do that. And it's not an issue. But I would much rather look at, instead of coming up with some sort of an artificial patch window, which is what I think a lot of organizations do because it makes upper management happy about the technical things that they don't understand. I think it makes more sense to say, okay, look, the IT department needs to use their judgment. If it's something that can be patched in the middle of the day, do it. If it's something that can be patched overnight, do it. We're all cognizant of what is referred to as a backout plan or a recovery plan. So if you look at a particular system and say, you know, look, I really just want to change just this one thing at this point in time, and I don't want to be changing anything else at the same time. So fine, let's just do that Wednesday night, realizing that do we have enough time from the Wednesday night change window to, you know, Thursday morning in order to get the system back up and running if that was actually necessary. And if you can say yes to that, and if you're prepared to allocate that time to that, then, and you have appropriate backups and so forth, then you shouldn't have any problem doing it Wednesday night. And then you're completely isolating that change and no other change happened at that time to the organization. That in itself is actually the best risk management methodology available. is to completely isolate changes, do one thing at a time. So this fundamentally is an oppositional approach to this artificial, well, we're only going to have two change management cycles every month. You know, we're going to do it every other Thursday morning. So I think that I don't have really a problem with, say, upper management saying, you know, we're willing to accept a total network outage for 2 hours at 4 a.m. on Thursday morning. That's great, because then the IT department can look at that and say, okay, so for things that we deem are going to potentially be causing a full network outage, or at least the perception of a full network outage to the end users, then we're going to do it at that point in time. So what I'm saying is it has to be a more sophisticated approach, and certainly under no circumstances is an approach that says we're just not going to install the patches. That's just not an acceptable approach. And it ends up costing you obscene amounts of money in the long run when you don't keep things up to date. I mean, every single year I do a full upgrade on the accounting package that we use for the business. And that is because it is then a predictable process. It's a predictable project that is going to take a predictable amount of time. And then I'm not dealing with, you know, old software, having to deal with, even if it's just a functionality problem, I don't have to deal with that because I'm always using the latest and greatest software packages. The most amount of money that I've ever seen organizations have to spend in terms of IT costs, hard and soft costs, comes from not engaging in an approach of ongoing keeping things up to date. So holding on to old dead things and saying, oh, well, we can't change it, or we can't upgrade it, or it's going to cost too much money for the software package. We don't want to spend the money on the software package. So if you don't spend the money on the software package now, well, not only are you going to have to spend the money on the software package later, but you're not going to be able to control the timing of that expenditure. And there's a whole bunch of other mess associated with that as well. And it usually comes down to business urgency issues and software incompatibility issues. And we have a client who had just waited too long to upgrade their accounting package, and their accounting package is very sophisticated and complicated. And the result of it is they're paying obscene amounts of money to the software developer for that accounting package, or the software support for that accounting package, to be able to update all of the reports for the accounting package. And the reality is that this is something that should have been done 6 years ago. So when you delay and you don't take things in bite-sized chunks, then it becomes one enormous, ugly, horrifically expensive chunk that you really don't have control over the timing of. Instead, the crisis at hand is controlling the timing of. So virtual patching has a place, but it is not a substitute for actual patching. And this virtual patching topic is, I think it's much more difficult for the small to medium business market to achieve. In fact, I can't even begin to tell you of another IT consulting firm that I know of or have heard of that has the technical capabilities to actually do virtual patching correctly, and that is because they just don't have network security architects in their employ. So what then becomes an obtainable approach in the SMB space? And that is just install the patches, right? Just actually install the patches. All right, well, on to toll fraud here. Toll fraud, you'd think that this was a concept that had died some time ago, and it hasn't. It's not dead. Apparently, telecom toll fraud has completely morphed into a new, more insidious and pervasive risk that is actually very difficult to mitigate. Certainly, no one person or no one organization could even mitigate this risk by themselves. And I'm going to post the article to this because it's very technically detailed and they've got some really great diagrams in there about how it is that cell phone carrier fraud is happening and how it's perpetrated. And you know, if you're interested in seeing how this whole what was previously called toll fraud and now has morphed into just telecom fraud and of course cellular fraud in general, has how that's morphed over time, please check out the article associated with this show, and the link to that article about that topic will be posted. Now, I want to talk briefly about the Amazon Echo. You may know about the Amazon Echo being this sort of device that can answer questions and order things for you and do certain things. Well, the reality is that it's been actually proven that this device is recording all the time, and it's recording private conversations, and it's been referred to as the Imperial Probe Droid because it is effectively a device that is spying on you all of the time in your home, whether or not you think you've activated it. But that's the reality of it. And this has been irrefutably proven because there was a homicide in a home with an Amazon Echo that was in that location. And a judge provided a ruling that gave the authorities permission to examine the audio recordings from that Amazon Echo. And even though no one had spoken the word Alexa in order to supposedly, you know, wake up the Amazon Echo device, the all of these recordings of all of this content that had been going on in that space where the double homicide, it was actually double homicide, where that had occurred, that, you know, audio was available. So if you think that you have, you know, an Apple device or an Amazon device or a Google device in your home and these things are not recording everything that's going on all the time, I think you're delusional. In fact, Google just put out another patent where, as part of the patent application, they specified that their desire is to have video surveillance of you in every room of your home so that they can track your behavior and predict what you might need to buy and send that to you to enhance the specificity of your advertising preferences. You know, I mean, if you're not totally creeped out by this stuff, I don't know what's going to. So certainly I don't advocate the procurement of any of those things. All right. So I want to finish up the show here with this topic of servers. You know, servers seem to be getting expensive, and so people are trying to find ways to not have an expensive server. They've looked into virtualizing it and putting these things into cloud hosting accounts such as Azure or Amazon Web Services or Google Cloud, these sorts of things. And of course, I've already established this many times on this show previously, that if you simply run the numbers, in about 18 months of paying for a cloud-hosted virtual server, you will have spent exactly the same amount of money as if you had bought a quality server with a 7-year warranty. So again, 18 months of cloud hosting services is equivalent to if you had just done capital expenditure and bought the server yourself and put it in. All right. So, I mean, you know, is cloud, would they be doing cloud hosting things if it wasn't profitable, if it was cheaper for them? you know, if it was, so no, they're not going to be doing cloud hosting services. They're not offering these cloud hosting services if they're not making money doing it. Therefore, you have to ask the question, does it make sense for you to use those cloud hosting services? In some case, it does. But I still don't see where hosting virtual servers is cost effective. I think it's a fantastic way to light money on fire and to have significantly increased IT expenditures. Now, that being said, what are our different options for being able to host these things on premise? Of course, you have the real server approach, which tends to be the only game in town in a lot of circumstances. We did some previous discussions about pre-made OEM appliances for various tasks, and I pretty much nixed those options because you could do it cheaper with higher quality and better options, lower total cost of ownership, if you were to not use an OEM appliance and just use a server that you had designed for the purpose. So finally, we come to this topic of, can I just run a server on a NAS, on a network attached storage appliance? There are NASs out there for sale, of course. Synology is the primary manufacturer of such things. And I've talked before about how Synology does not offer their Synology replacement service, which is a moderately acceptable hardware warranty. They don't offer that on anything smaller than their 2U, which are 2 units in height. So it's a size specification. They're 2U NASs. So that has not, however, stopped them from offering many 1U NASs where they claim that you can do server virtualization cost effectively. Well, you can't if you cannot get a viable hardware response time warranty contract on that appliance. So that's a failure right there. But I did actual real testing, real scenario testing in a real environment with a virtual machine running on a NAS, on a Synology NAS. It was appropriately sized. It had plenty, and I mean plenty of resources, basically the same sort of equivalent resources as what you would have on a real Dell PowerEdge server if that virtualized server had been provisioned. So we're talking equivalent specs, equivalent horsepower. What I saw was that the performance on the NAS is just too slow for any level of satisfaction in my viewpoint. So would it be acceptable as a secondary domain controller? Yes, probably as a secondary domain controller, but I would not use it as a primary domain controller, and I wouldn't try to use it as anything else, really. I just wouldn't. And you have to accept that if you're going to run a virtualized domain controller on a NAS, your labor costs are going to be much higher just because the thing is, well, it's slow. It's just significantly slower. And you're going to have false positives potentially with monitoring. Patching it is going to be more time consuming. So again, your long-term total cost of ownership is going to be higher for something like that. I think it could work as a secondary domain controller, especially hosted offsite on an offsite NAS where you were going to buy the NAS anyways. This is the key piece. If you're going to buy the NAS anyway in order to store offsite backups, then it does make sense at that point to get in a slightly larger, more appropriately sized NAS to be able to run that offsite domain controller as a virtual machine on it. But outside of that, I'm not going to recommend that strategy to you. So we're going back to the whole realm of sometimes you just need a real server. Well, that's it for today's show. Hope you enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
The midterm elections are over, but the questions linger. Why were lines so long in some places?